Let's begin today with the story of a patch of barren land, 800 miles or 1,300 kilometers from the North Pole, that became a thriving town with over 2,000 permanent residents, a hospital, a university, even a shopping mall. A place naturally hostile to civilization that, despite its best efforts, yielded to a band of miners' desire to civilize it. A place that was built, then destroyed, and then built back again. A rare company town that, through a combination of luck and work, became just simply a town. Let's begin with the story of a strangely civilized place. Today, the story of Longyearbyen, Svalbard. When John Munro Longyear sold his mining interest in the place that had become his namesake, Longyear City, it was bought by a Norwegian mining company called Store Norsk in 1916. Now, on Extremities, we try not to give you too many names you have to remember, but Store Norsk, or SNSK as it's commonly known, is one of the names that it might be useful to keep in the back of your head. That's because, for most of the next 75 or so years, the history of Longyearbyen and the history of Store Norsk are inextricably linked. Until the 1990s, nearly everyone in Longyearbyen was employed by Store Norsk or did some service that relied on the people employed by Store Norsk. Longyearbyen was, by all measures, a company town. Not only did most people on the island get paid their money by Store Norsk, they quite literally and quite physically got their money from Store Norsk. With approval from the Norwegian Central Bank, Store Norsk created their own currency, which was used throughout Longyearbyen. Over the next few decades, Longyearbyen slowly built itself up. 1921 saw the first church in Longyearbyen and the first school, which was inside the church's reading room. In the 1930s, the first radio station, the first road, and the very first signs of tourism, as a steamship began to regularly ferry curious travelers up in the summer who wondered what it would be like to live in endless days and nights among polar bears. But in the 1940s, Longyearbyen's burgeoning prosperity came to a halt because, of course, that's when World War II began to take over Europe and the world. In 1940, the Germans invaded and occupied mainland Norway, but, at least for the time being, they left Longyearbyen and the rest of Svalbard untouched. Longyearbyen had a lucky break, but the Allies were worried that that luck wouldn't last long. With Svalbard's rich coal reserves, its communications infrastructure, plus its strategic position, the Allies feared that the Germans would be able to use it to fuel their army and to interrupt the Arctic route to Russia. The Allies considered trying to occupy Svalbard and Longyearbyen to defend it, but they worried that it would be either too difficult or too costly. Instead, they came to a simple conclusion. Longyearbyen had to be destroyed. In fact, all of Svalbard had to be destroyed, and so Operation Gauntlet was commenced. On August 25th, 1941, a band of Allied forces, Canadian-led, but with some British and a few Norwegians who had escaped occupation, landed on the shores of Svalbard. Their first order of business was to evacuate all civilians from Spitsbergen. All the Norwegians in Svalbard gathered in Longyearbyen, where they boarded a ship and were taken to Scotland to wait out the war. After all, they couldn't go home to Norway, which was under Nazi occupation. In total, 915 Norwegians were evacuated from Longyearbyen. Meanwhile, the troops set to destroying all of Longyearbyen's communications equipment, mining equipment, and coal, and they did it all in secret. The Germans didn't discover the operation until September 5th, once it had already been completed. Longyearbyen continued to play a role in the war. Despite its destruction, the Germans briefly occupied it to gather meteorological data, but they left when the British occupied Barentsburg. In September 1943, the Germans decided that the Allies hadn't actually demolished Longyearbyen enough, and they sent two battleships to complete the city's destruction. In the end, only four of Longyearbyen's buildings survived the war. Its hospital, a single office building, one house, and a power station. Everything else was reduced to rubble. Once the war ended, miners began to return to Longyearbyen and rebuild the city, and they did so at an impressive pace. Mining output reached pre-war levels within only 3 years. At this point, Longyearbyen was still a company town, still run by Store Norsk. The company ran the schools, fire department, roads, sewers, everywhere you might normally expect to see the government, all you saw was Store Norsk, but as time passed, Longyearbyen slowly began to creep out from under the company's shadow. In 1949, Longyearbyen became home to Svalbard's first newspaper, Svalbard Posten, which still publishes today. Soon after came the first farm and a local radio station. Longyearbyen's transition to a self-sufficient town was helped, as well, by its airport, which would eventually allow for the introduction of tourism, one of the city's only industries outside of mining. Flights to Svalbard began in the 1950s when Norwegian Air Force planes would do postal flights. In 1959, an airstrip was built, and the first commercial flights began to arrive irregularly in the winter. In 1975, Longyearbyen's airport officially opened, initially with 4 flights a week to Norway and occasional flights to Russia. Another important change came in 1974 when the Norwegian government bought 1/3 of Store Norsk. By just 2 years later, they owned nearly all of the company, but still, the company was running the town, not the government. In the 1980s, Store Norsk began allowing citizens to have their own personal cars, and the company's private currency was replaced with the standard Norwegian krone, but the true transformation of Longyearbyen came in the 1990s when the Norwegian government began a concentrated effort to turn Longyearbyen into a real, genuine, non-company town. One step was diversifying its economy. The small Longyearbyen provision store was replaced by a shopping mall, the university center was opened, and for the first time, Longyearbyen got a hotel. Another major step was creating meaningful local government. For decades, the city's only local government had been the Svalbard Council, a board that consisted mainly of Store Norsk officials and Norwegian government personnel, some elected and some appointed. In 1993, political parties were allowed to run for seats on the council, and in 2002, the Svalbard Council was replaced with the fully elected Longyearbyen City Council. With this increased representation came more responsibilities for those representatives. In 1993, the Norwegian government took over the city's education system, fire department, sewage and roads management. Finally, traditional government services were actually run by the government. The final step towards becoming a real city was a diverse population. In the 1940s, there were more than 4 men for every woman on the island. Now, thanks to its move away from mining, it has about a 4-3 ratio of men to women. Not totally equal, but a whole lot better, and in large part because of its visa-free policy, Longyearbyen has seen a significant Thai and Filipino population make it their home. Today, the story of that town, and specifically, how it became so damn civilized. Welcome back to Extremities. This is episode 2 of 6 in our season about Svalbard. If you haven't listened to episode 1, you should definitely do that now as it provides important context. We'll get back to the northernmost town in the world shortly, but first, I need to thank one of the sponsors that makes Extremities possible. Extremities was made possible by Ting. Ting is a solution for mobile phone service that gives you exactly what you get now for less. You see, most people only use a small fraction of their cell plan's allowance, but still pay for all of it. Ting offers nationwide LTE service in the US on 2 top networks, but instead of paying for all your talk, text, and data and only using some of it, with Ting, you pay nothing upfront for your talk, text, or data and only pay for what you use. Most everyone can bring both their cell phone and cell number over to Ting, so for most people, nothing changes except for the extra money they have at the end of the month. The average Ting bill is just $23 a month, so if you pay any more than that, it's worth checking it out. They also have crazy good customer support in case you ever need it, so all around, it's a great experience. Ting is offering Extremities listeners $25 in credit with no strings attached by going to ext.ting.com. Considering that the average monthly bill is $23, for most people, that's enough to cover a month of service, and at the end of that, if you're not convinced, all that happens was that you got a bunch of free cell service. Once again, by going to ext.ting.com, you'll get $25 in Ting credit so you can try them out and see how they'll save you money each month. But now, to Longyearbyen. About 2,000 people live in Longyearbyen, by far the majority of Svalbard's population. It's sort of a long, thin town nestled snugly in a small valley between 2 mountains. To the north, there's water, to the south, there's a long ascending valley, then to the east and west, there are those flanking mountains. This elongated shape makes the core of town essentially 2 main long roads parallel to the mountains, with some side streets intersecting them along the way. Longyearbyen is not a super dense town. There's plenty of empty space between buildings, making them seem almost haphazardly placed at times. Especially in the town center, there are a bunch of weirdly large parking lots between buildings, especially weird considering that there really aren't many cars there. The town center is definitively commercial. It's pretty much all stores, restaurants, and bars, punctuated by the occasional hotel. Longyearbyen is the center of the tourism industry in Svalbard, so while many shops are more utilitarian, catering to the locals, there are plenty others selling the things Arctic tourists want. To each side of that center, there are houses and apartments, mostly in the foothills of the two mountains. The town is only a mile or 1.6 kilometers from top to bottom, and at its widest, about 1,100 feet or 340 meters from side to side. Beyond tourism, the major function of Longyearbyen is as home to Svalbard's government, a government that works unlike any other government in the world. Svalbard, of course, is that international zone where anyone can set up a mine, a business, move in, pretty much do whatever, but despite the presence of settlements of other nations, Svalbard is still Norwegian territory and therefore it has a Norwegian government. This government, though, works in a rather unique way. Svalbard is run by a governor, but this governor doesn't do the usual things you might think of when you hear the word governor. You see, the governor of Svalbard doesn't actually have any role in passing legislation, and they aren't elected by the people. Instead, they report to the Norwegian Ministry of Justice and serve as Svalbard's chief of police, environmental protection authority, and key administrative officer. As chief of police, the governor oversees criminal investigations, law enforcement, and even search and rescue operations. In fact, the governor of Svalbard will often personally fly in helicopters or lead search and rescue missions for lost people. The other major part of the governor's job is environmental protection. It was specifically written into the Svalbard Treaty that Norway must maintain the environmental well-being of the land, and the governor is tasked with upholding that promise, and so the governor handles duties like managing flora and fauna, inspecting and controlling pollution, and maintaining preparedness for oil spills. As an administrator and public figure, the governor is also in charge of things like marriage and divorce on Svalbard, encouraging tourism, and keeping good relations with the foreign settlements in Svalbard. When it comes to laws, Svalbard is governed by the laws passed by the Norwegian government, and other local duties like schools, roads, and planning are handled by the only elected officials in Svalbard, the 15-member Longyearbyen Community Council. Again, despite being part of Norway, Svalbard has some rather unique laws, regulations, and conventions due to its rather extreme environment. One line that locals like to throw around there is that nobody is born or dies in Svalbard. Except for the occasional exception, that line holds up. Now, this is partially because of practicality, partially because of convention, and partially because of regulation. Longyearbyen's hospital is small, and while advanced for such an isolated small town, it still lacks the facilities that one would have in a big city. While the hospital would be able to handle a normal birth, it would struggle to respond to some potential childbirth complications, and so, typically, expectant mothers fly to either their hometowns on the mainland or to Tromsø, the nearest city in northern Norway, a few weeks before their due dates. The second part of that adage, though, is a bit more complicated. It's for a variety of reasons that nobody dies, at least of old age or long-term illnesses, on Svalbard. One reason is that there are very few old people in Svalbard. According to the Norwegian Statistics Bureau, which only publishes data on the Norwegian towns of Longyearbyen and Nielsund combined, there are 2,258 total residents in those two towns. Of those, only 36 are over the age of 67. You see, the thing is that very few people have generational roots in Svalbard. Very few people are truly from there, and there is no indigenous population of Svalbard. Even the very few families that have long histories in Svalbard only go back a few generations. For most people, Svalbard is a place they go to work for a few years. Therefore, when people get to retirement age, they're much more likely to go and live back in their hometowns or elsewhere in a less harsh environment that would have the support they would need in older age. Especially as people reach the final years of their lives, Longyearbyen Hospital just doesn't have the level of healthcare they would need. Therefore, notwithstanding everything else, natural forces push people back to the mainland. The final reason why people don't die on Svalbard is that you're not actually allowed to be buried in Svalbard. This wasn't always the case. In the early days of Svalbard's human history, burial was completely normal there, but in the modern era, the issues with this were realized. Due to the permafrost, buried bodies don't really decompose, and also, the shifting ground, as it freezes and melts, can actually push buried bodies to the surface over town. Therefore, the burial of bodies is now forbidden. In the end, though, it's more these social factors that leads to the lack of dying on Svalbard, at least of old age or illness. The reality, though, is that Svalbard is a dangerous place. It is one of the most extreme environments in the world permanently inhabited by humans. Everywhere you go, there are threats. Perhaps the most unique and acute of those threats being polar bears. Svalbard is one of the few places on Earth where polar bears and humans coexist. Polar bears, in fact, outnumber humans, with an estimated 3,000 of them living on the archipelago. Polar bears are unique among animals, as they are one of the only species that will hunt humans as food. Now, let's be clear. Humans are not at the top of their menu, and polar bear attacks on humans are extremely rare, but part of that is just because interaction between humans and polar bears is extremely rare. In a place like Svalbard, that interaction is much more common, and standing face to face with a polar bear is dangerous. It is for that reason that there is another unique law. Essentially, anyone leaving a settlement in Svalbard is required to carry some means of scaring off a polar bear. Usually, what is used is a flare gun. In addition, the government strongly recommends everyone leaving settlements to carry a gun. In practice, this recommendation is well respected. Basically, nobody leaves the towns without a rifle. In town, this leads to the initially jarring sight of plenty of people walking around with rifles as they walk their dog or make their way outside of the center. Within Longyearbyen, carrying a loaded gun is against the law, the chamber has to be visibly open, and it's also prohibited to take rifles into any public building. Most public places, like the supermarket or other shops, will therefore have gun lockers by their entrance for public use. Walking around the main settlements without a gun is considered safe, since a bear would never make it downtown without being spotted, and so tourists are able to carry on fairly normally, only leaving the settlements with armed guides. Most of the time, when someone is lucky enough to see a polar bear, it's from afar and there is no issue. Sometimes, though, there are closer encounters with a bear. The general protocol is to first do your best to scare away the bear, usually with flares. The idea is to do as much as possible to avoid a physical confrontation between a human and a polar bear, but if the confrontation arises, the human comes first and you take the shot. The killing of such a rare and threatened species is, of course, a tragedy. Nobody in Svalbard wants to kill a polar bear, but it does, unfortunately, happen. This is especially true recently, as changing environments have led to more and more starving and desperate bears willing to go after humans for food. The death of a polar bear by human hands on Svalbard is not something that happens often. It is not taken lightly. Each time a polar bear is killed by a human in Svalbard, it makes the news. Not just the local or national news, but international news. It's the kind of thing that is talked about all around the world. The last incident happened in 2018 as a polar bear attacked an armed guard protecting a group of cruise tourists walking on shore in a remote area of Svalbard. Another guide shot the bear dead, and immediately, this incident attracted attention. Articles about this incident appeared in the Washington Post, BBC, NPR, South China Morning Post, New York Times, ABC Australia. It was big, big news. Around the world, people were debating the ethics of a polar bear having to die for following its instincts when humans entered its territory. That, however, is the reality of life on Svalbard. All of those aspects, the lack of birth, the lack of death, the gun requirement, the confrontations with polar bears, those are all ways that life in Svalbard is unique. They are the byproducts of living in a place so far north, so far isolated from other human settlement, but perhaps the most unique aspect of life on Svalbard, especially in its capital of Longyearbyen, is just how normal it is. This normalcy is not normal for where Longyearbyen is. The life of a resident of Longyearbyen just isn't that different than that of life of any Norwegian. Meanwhile, it is drastically different than that of pretty much everyone else living so far north. This normalcy is accentuated when you consider just how different the life of someone from Arctic Alaska is from someone from New York, just how different the life of someone from Arctic Canada is from someone from Toronto, just how different the life of someone from Arctic Russia is from someone from Moscow. The Arctic is not a normal place, but somehow, the people of Longyearbyen get to live fairly normal lives in one of the world's most abnormal places. Crafting that normalcy is no easy task. Turning the world's northernmost town into a thriving community didn't just happen by chance. It's the product of decades of intention and chance. We're going to discuss much more about the world's most weirdly normal place, But first, I need to thank one of our sponsors. Extremities was made possible by Dashlane. Dashlane is what I and so many others use to stay safe online. There are a huge variety of threats on the internet, but Dashlane serves as a toolbox to address all of them. Rather than getting a bunch of different tools for safety, Dashlane gives you them all. They have a VPN, a password manager, dark web monitoring, breach alerts, secure file storage, and more. Using their password manager, for example, allows you to have a big, long, complex password for each site you use so that if one gets breached, all your other accounts won't get compromised. When you go to log in to any site, Dashlane securely autofills your password so it actually ends up easier than filling in a short password. With all the different tools it has, Dashlane represents a fantastic deal, and it's an even better deal considering that if you go to dashlane.com/extremities, you can get a 30-day free trial of Dashlane Premium to see for yourself. If you're convinced, at the end of that, you can also use the code extremities for 10% off upgrading to Premium. Once again, that's dashlane.com/extremities for a 30-day free trial, then the code extremities for 10% off upgrading to Premium. But now, to Longyearbyen. Just to review, Svalbard is well in the Arctic Circle. As the northernmost town in the world, that should be obvious, but I'm just reiterating. Personally, there's only one other place that I've been to in the Arctic Circle. Utqiagvik, or as it was called when I was there in 2017 before its name change, Barrow, Alaska. This Arctic town is far further south and far larger than Longyearbyen. 4,500 people live in Utqiagvik, and it's almost 500 miles or 800 kilometers closer to the equator. When I was there, though, I made an expedition to the grocery store to see for myself whether a rumored phenomenon was true. The absurdly high prices in this small, relatively poor town. It was $15 for a bottle of hand sanitizer, $17 for a frozen pizza, $20 for a pack of toilet paper, $22 for a box of diapers, $30 for some stain remover. The cheapest restaurant I went to while there, a fairly typical American Chinese restaurant, did not have a single main course on its menu under $20, and most were closer to $30. The problem it has, as a town with no road links in and out, is that most everything had to come by plane, which is, of course, expensive. They typically are able to make a shipment or two by barge in the summer when the sea ice melts, but throughout the rest of the year, they solely rely on air freight. Going to Svalbard, I expected the same phenomenon. I had heard, after all, that the phenomenon in Utqiagvik was not unique and the entirety of the Arctic typically had a naturally high cost of living. I was, however, wrong. I made a similar fact-finding expedition to the Svalbard Butikken, Longyearbyen's one and only grocery store, and found the following prices. 1 liter of orange juice, $5.01. Whipped cream can, $4.34. 1 kilogram of bananas, $4.23. 1.5 liter bottle of Coke, $4.18. 1.5 liter bottle of store brand cola, $2. 1 liter of milk, $4.31. 54 pack of diapers, $9.10. Now, these prices might not match Walmart or Costco, but they're really just not much different than the rest of Norway, a quite expensive country. This is intriguing because Svalbard is far further removed from civilization than Utqiagvik in northern Alaska. Now, there are a few reasons why this is. One is that Svalbard, despite its isolation, doesn't actually have to ship all its food in by plane. Utqiagvik doesn't have a year-round port and definitely not one that can accept large or even medium-sized ships. In Svalbard, however, the maximum draft its port accepts, the distance between the waterline and the bottom of the hull, is 30 feet or 9 meters, and the maximum length is 1,100 feet or 335 meters. That allows for decent-sized cargo ships, which benefit from economies of scale, to bring goods to Longyearbyen from northern Norway in fewer than 3 days. From the perspective of food cost overall, Longyearbyen is just like any other slightly expensive Norwegian town, not the orders of magnitude more expensive like some other Arctic outposts. For housing, though, things are a bit more tricky. Like many places in the world, Longyearbyen is experiencing its own mini housing crisis. The reasons behind that are part social, part natural. As you might remember, Longyearbyen sits in a valley between two mountains. In fact, Spitsbergen, the name of the island that's home to Longyearbyen, literally means pointed mountains. And for the citizens of Longyearbyen, living between those pointed mountains creates risks, most notably, avalanches. On December 19th, 2015, that risk became a reality when an avalanche hit Longyearbyen. 10 houses were hit, literally moved off their foundations, and slid over 60 feet or 20 meters in all directions. The neighborhood, once two even lines of houses, ended up a jumbled mess. The community in Longyearbyen responded immediately. In addition to the official search and rescue operation, nearby residents, armed with shovels, began digging through the snow and rubble, looking for victims, and though they did all they could, in the end, two lives were lost and another 8 injured. The avalanche was caused, as most avalanches are, by shifting temperatures and high winds near an unstable slope of land. In the aftermath, it came to light that the avalanche risk had been identified in a 2001 report, but seemingly nothing had been done. Afterwards, 40 homes were evacuated because of the risk, and in the years since, Longyearbyen has been more careful. There have been other avalanches, but none have been deadly. As a result of these avalanches, not only are those dozens of homes gone, but the city is now more cautious about where homes can be built. Coupled with that avalanche-induced reduction in supply, the strong tourism figures in the town recently have coaxed many homeowners to rent on Airbnb and other sites. A total of 32 are currently listed, which is not insignificant for such a small town. This has further reduced the stock, but has also helped fit all the tourists wanting to come, as, even as fast as they're building them, the hotels do fill up. Part of the issue is that the government can't really intervene in this housing crisis. With the way the system of governance is set up in Svalbard, there are essentially no welfare systems on the archipelago. This is, of course, hugely different than in mainland Norway, as it means the government couldn't, for example, subsidize housing for low-income residents. The idea behind that is that, if you come to Svalbard, you're supposed to be able to handle yourself. You are required to have a job, an income, and a residence in Svalbard. The only exception would be retirees, although they still have to prove they can financially sustain themselves. Overall, that means the only thing working to solve this little Longyearbyen housing crisis is market forces, and, as we know, little supply and much demand leads to high prices. The saving grace of that is, though, that finding a job is easy. The housing crisis stems from the fact that there are just so many jobs, and the economy, especially the tourism sector, is just so robust. Between 2010 and 2018, the number of yearly visitors to Longyearbyen has more than doubled from 35,000 to 73,000. The best news is, though, that tourism isn't all Longyearbyen's got. While still heavily reliant on tourism and mining, Longyearbyen's economy is diversified. There's the mines, there's the university, there's plenty of research facilities, there's even a small and burgeoning brewery. It's a far cry from the company town of only a few decades ago. We'll take a deep dive into this economy in episode 5, but it's just worth knowing that Longyearbyen is a thriving place. It's in its prime. These are the good old days, and things are still only improving. In many ways, Longyearbyen's economy is about being the nexus of Svalbard. Everyone leaves and arrives through Longyearbyen, so the city benefits from every research expedition, cruise ship, North Pole tour, or whatever that comes through Svalbard. A very important part of that nexus is Longyearbyen Hospital.
Longyearbyen Hospital was built in 1916, the first hospital, and it's because of the mining laws that says that if you're running a mine here, you have to provide housing and food for the miners and a hospital.
That's Axel Bilisk, the head nurse and manager at the hospital.
My background is a nurse anesthetist. And I came here in 2004, in September, and have been here since.
Now, Longyearbyen Hospital is, unsurprisingly, very, very small.
It's 7 beds. We have 6 nurses plus me. There are 4 doctors. At the moment, there are 1 surgeon and 3 general practitioners. At other times, it has been 2 surgeons and 2 general practitioners. But we do very little surgery. It's sort of in case of emergencies that we shall do surgery.
There are 2 things that make the kind of cases that Longyearbyen Hospital has to deal with so unique. One is that the population of Svalbard is just so young and healthy. Since everyone there is of working age, it sees fewer heart attacks, for example, along with other conditions common with older age. Especially in a place where danger lurks around every corner, they get a lot of traumatic injuries, especially for a 7-bed hospital.
It's mainly snowmobile accidents, mostly broken legs and wrists and arms. During summer, it's also a few fractures for people walking. But then, of course, we also have hypothermia.
On top of that, the hospital gets plenty of more exceptional injuries. In the past few years, it's seen snowmobilers falling through the ice, it's seen avalanche victims, it's even seen a few patients who were attacked by polar bears, a very rare occurrence. Just 1 year ago, though, in summer 2018, the hospital saw one of its busiest and toughest days ever. A tourist vessel, making one of its regular trips from Longyearbyen to the Russian towns, was coming into dock at Barentsburg. It was July, the peak of the summer tourist season, and this boat was packed with 121 passengers aboard. Somehow, just seconds before reaching the dock, one of the two propellers, as this was a catamaran, was engaged and the boat slammed into the dock at high speed. People were injured. This was clearly a challenge for Svalbard's tiny medical system. Barentsburg has a hospital too, but it's even smaller and less advanced than Longyearbyen's. The most seriously injured were flown to Longyearbyen, but others were brought in later by boat.
So what we did was we had doctors making a quick check of them to see who is seriously injured and who can just sit in a chair and perhaps not even have to be at the hospital. So a lot of people were sent to a building next to us where they were treated for or help with food and things like that. And the doctor decided who had to stay at the hospital.
In the time that it had taken to get everyone from Barentsburg to Longyearbyen, extra doctors and nurses had flown in from Tromsø in northern Norway to help out. This is fairly regular protocol for whenever something serious happens, as Longyearbyen's four doctors just aren't enough. While most of the injuries were quite minor, a few were serious enough that they could not be fully treated in Svalbard.
And then we started to sort out who had to go fast and who could go with a later military airplane that was expected to come in the evening.
In this case, those that had to go fast took the air ambulance that regularly comes up from northern Norway to evacuate patients that Longyearbyen can't handle. As there were more than that air ambulance could handle, the military airplane was the exceptional solution for this one large incident. One challenge with these and other patients that the hospital has to deal with is language. As such an international place, both in terms of residents and the tourists that visit it, no one person can know all the languages of the patients that come in. The staff all speak Norwegian and English, but for other languages, they have a few solutions.
Russian is usually, the governor has a Russian interpreter, so Russian is quite easy usually because we can get help from them. And a lot of the fishing vessels are Russian or Norwegian. But sometimes we get people from totally different countries. And what we use then is we use interpreters by telephone. The last years it has been a lot of Chinese people coming here. They themselves very often cannot speak English. But of course, sometimes they go in a group where someone speaks quite good English, so they can interpret for us. But most of it is done by telephone.
On days when there hasn't been a boat crash or polar bear attack or an avalanche or any of the other big exciting things, the hospital is essentially a general practitioner's office.
On an ordinary day, what we do is a doctor's office work. You know, we have take blood tests, check the blood pressure, taking x-rays. Some people with cancer and illnesses like that have some kind of treatment that we do on behalf of a university hospital. We can do the practical things here if they live, you know, here on the island.
When working at a hospital as small as Longyearbyen's, one has to be mentally and physically ready to go weeks without anything serious, but then be able to go and respond to that life-threatening accident in an instant. Having a hospital at all, though, in a place as far north and as isolated as Svalbard, is a luxury. There are plenty of Arctic towns that don't even have a doctor, let alone a hospital. It is just one of many aspects of life in Longyearbyen that make it downright civilized, at least by Arctic standards. Pretty much everything we've said so far over these first two episodes, though, has to deal with only one side of Svalbard, the Norwegian one. There's a whole other world on Svalbard, the Russian one. The details of a place where two countries exist in one territory are fascinating, and over the next two episodes, we'll be looking at why and how Russian Svalbard exists. Extremities is written and produced by Adam Chase and myself, Sam Denby, edited by Eric Schneider, and this is a Wendover Productions podcast. We'll be back next week for episode 3 of Svalbard's Story.